Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Good evening and welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd, and I'm here tonight with my co-host, Red Beckman, and Dr. Kate, and also Kurt McKenzie is here with us tonight, and just looking forward to this show very much. I'm going to open us up with a prayer while we're waiting for all of our guests to get in. I'm getting a message that I've got a little bit of poor sound quality is poor, so I want to say this prayer, and then if the sound quality is not better, we will maybe call back in. Maybe my Skype connection isn't that good. But let's pray. Almighty Father God, we just come before you. I'm just so thankful for the way that you bless me and my family this week. And just thankful for my friends and especially our listeners here at Walls in Our Minds. We pray tonight, Father, that what we do and say will glorify you. We pray that your Spirit go before us in everything that we do and we say here tonight. We just want the truth to get out there, and we want people to understand it and to see it and to hear it. And we just ask you to take control of this show, Father. It's in the name of your Son, Yeshua, that we pray. Amen. And who have I got on with me tonight that's live already?
Terry, I'm here.
Kurt?
I'm here.
Do we have anybody else that is on live?
I'm on. This is Red.
Hi, Red. Well, Red, we're waiting for Mr. Bannister to join us. He may have tried to call in, and we had a Skype caller that was had their hand raised, but we weren't getting any sound out of him, so I don't know if there's a mic problem or what's going on, but I'm sure it'll all straighten out here shortly. Well, Red, you kind of inspired an awful lot of things over the years, and I know when I heard Joe Bannister telling about his original story about how he had heard Dina Kidd talking about the fraudulent ratification or the non-ratification of the 16th Amendment and some of those things that inspired him to start his investigation. While we're waiting for Joe to join us, how about you give us a little bit of history of that time in your life and what was going on?
Yeah, I'm catching a certain amount of feedback or something, and you're not coming through as clear as I would like.
Well, you talk, I'll drop and call back in while you're talking.
Yeah. As I have said many a time, I knew there was something very seriously wrong in our country way back in the 50s. I was busy trying to raise a family and build up a logging business and all of that, but I tried to keep abreast of the political, what was happening in this country, and I tried to make it work. I tried to make the system work the way they explained it to me when I went to high school. I tried to you know, apply myself to the problems that we have, and it was a lot of frustration for me. And then in 1975, I got up on the soapbox and started speaking out, and trying to get my fellow Americans alerted to what I seen coming in the future. Then we ran our first TV special across the state of Montana in June of 1976. I have to stop and think a little bit. That's a long time ago. The television station that we bought the time on told me that they had never run a program on their station that had generated the response that they got from that one program. It wasn't until 1979 that we decided to take the bull by the horns and do some of this on our own, because I felt I had been at the National Tax Strike Convention in Denver in 1976, October of 76. That's where I first met Dan and Senior and Dan Junior Pilla, who are real pillars in the protest, the Patriot movement in this country. And of course, there were some other very credible people there. Claire Kelly, of course, was outstanding, and many others. And I listened in on all those people speaking, and of course, we had hoped that we would be able to have some help from, I considered them to be more expert than I, and I would have liked to had more support from some of those people, but we didn't get it. So in 79, we produced our own special, one-hour TV special called People and Taxes, and we bought the time on commercial stations. We ran that. There was about a half a dozen different TV stations in Montana, and we ran it on all of them over a period of a couple of 3 months. Well, one of them was about 6 months later, the Missoula, Montana station, and we tried our best to follow up those TV showings with rallies in the various communities across Montana. And we had such a tremendous response. We had a tremendous, people just jumped on this. They just loved what they was hearing. And, of course, we were very thrilled with the results that we had. And so in 1980, we produced another one. I can't remember the exact title on that one. It'll come to me. My 83-year-old mind is kind of wore out, and it doesn't always get me the answers I want real quick. But anyway, we ran a second series across the state of Montana, and we followed with rallies, and we did these rallies, and we had tremendous crowds, 300-400 people. We had 280 people at the meeting in Havre, Montana. That was northern Montana. And a small town, I think 8,000 or 10,000 people at the most. That's a small town in most people's idea. But we had tremendous response. We had people coming and asking a lot of questions. I had put together as much information as I could. And we had that meeting in Havre, Montana. And there was a gentleman there that came to the meeting, and he was the last one to leave. I had been doing these meetings every night. I was burning the candle at both ends, and I will never forget what happened, because this fellow took some of the literature. He took one of everything that we had, and he'd have stayed there all night long if we'd had enough energy left to burn. But he took the material, and he was the last one to leave. And my wife and I were breathing a sigh of relief, because 280 people in a town that size with no other advertising other than the announcement on the end of our television special. Now, we have to look back and recognize that TV wasn't all that strong at that point. They were getting their television out of Great Falls, Montana, and they only had the one. Most people only had the access to that one TV station, so we had a captive audience, and that happened in many places. In Billings, Montana, the largest city in the state, where our home base was, they had two television stations. There was no cable. There were no satellite dishes. There were if you wanted television, you got it with an antenna, and you got one or the other of those two stations. So we had a tremendous audience when we ran these, and we bought prime time. We paid to preempt stories or programs, serials like Gunsmoke and such. We would preempt those. It would cost us a few bucks more, but we would preempt those programs, and that really helped get us a tremendous audience. The gentleman that came to the meeting in Haver and became so interested was a genius. He was a young fellow in his 30s, but one of the most intelligent people I've ever met in my life. He's a farmer up there in Montana. He has just turned 70 years of age. I about said the wrong thing there. But anyway, he would call me if I was in Billings. He would call me late in the evening, and sometimes we would be on the phone until after midnight. And he was a man with lots of questions. And the one night, he said, "You know, Red," he said, "you have a long list of lies that the politicians have told. That long list, of course, was, I say they lied to us about Pearl Harbor and Korea and Vietnam. Social Security, not Vietnam, because that was before that was before that happened, really. It was in the process, I guess. But they lied about Social Security and the Kennedy assassination and all of those things. And I challenged every audience. I'd say, "Can you tell me one time where the politicians, the people that we send to Washington and such, where they have told us the truth on any major happening in our history?" And, of course, I was never challenged with that. I would challenge the audience, but I would never have, in all the years that I did that, I never had anybody come back at me and say, "Well, they told us the truth about such and such a happening." Well, there weren't any. It was everything was a lie, and so we were on the phone with this gentleman, and he said, "You challenge the audience." He said, "Do you suppose this was June of 1980?" He said, "Do you suppose that the 16th Amendment, the income tax amendment to our Constitution, was never lawfully ratified?" And that took me by surprise. And then I said, "You know, with the track record that our public servants have for truth, they don't have any kind of a track record. We have to assume the track record tells us that they lied to us. And my friend said, we're going to find out if they lied to us. We're going to find out if that amendment was properly ratified. And he rallied some other farmers, ranchers, small business people, about six or eight people is about all it was. And they gave themselves a name. They call themselves the Montana Historians. And it went from there. And by January of 1983, we had copies of all of the legislative journals having to do with the 16th Amendment ratification. Before that happened, of course, I wrote my first book in the fall of 80, and we already knew at that point that the 16th Amendment was a fraud because my friend had discovered there was a book out there that we had to find, and it was having to do with the ratification of all of the amendments up to at that time period. I don't remember exactly what time period it was, but anyway, when we finally found one of those books, the Library of Congress in Washington, and the congressmen and senators were no help, whatever. They said that the Senate Document 240, that's the book we wanted, and they said that document does not exist any longer. Well, we knew that if it didn't exist, somebody had violated federal law because they were destroying official records. And so we finally had one of our friendly patriots found a way into the state law library in Helena, Montana, the state capital, and he got into a storage room there, and he found a copy of Senate Document 240. And when I wrote my book, Born Again Republic, in the fall of 80, I state in that book that the 16th Amendment had not been ratified, and we knew we had the evidence to prove that it had not been ratified. And so
Red.
The law that never was came out in April of 1985. So that'll give you some idea of the chronology involved.
Red, I just want to let you know that Joe's been listening to you. Our guest tonight has a live mic, and I'd like to get him introduced. It is my pleasure to welcome to Walls in Our Minds Mr. Joe Bannister. Good evening, Joe.
Hi, Terry. Thanks very much for having me. Hi, Red. Hi, Kate.
Well, it's good to hear you, and it's better yet to know that you're still in the battle, and more so than you were back there four or five years ago. So it's good to hear from you.
Well, yeah, thank you very much, and thanks to the IRS. There's always a battle to be fought, isn't there? They're just not going to tell the truth no matter what.
Well, Joe, give our listeners a brief background on yourself, because we've got a lot of guests on tonight. We have a pretty good, strong group of listeners here at Walls in Our Minds, but I've got a feeling tonight we've got some folks that maybe have never been here before, and I'd just like for them to get a little bit of a taste. Most of them know who you are, but for those who don't, just give us a little bit of your history before we dig into some topics.
All righty, Terry, thank you. Well, I'm just about 49 years old and middle class upbringing, Roman Catholic, brought up, born, baptized, First Communion, all Catholic schools, on and on. And so I would say that my parents were good enough to raise me with the morals and to know the difference between right and wrong, and certainly was once in a while punished as a child for doing the wrong thing. So I definitely learned what, you know, the difference between right and wrong. And as I progressed through high school and college, I decided that perhaps an accounting career might be the best. I actually had a mentor who suggested that an accounting discipline would be the best to pursue because I would always have work. And boy, did he turn out to be correct. I went to San Jose State University, San Jose, California, and obtained a degree in accounting. From there, I graduated in 1986 and worked for a number of years in the private sector once I graduated from college. And I earned my CPA certificate from the state of California in 1991. And when it got to be about 1991, 1992 time frame, I looked at what my boss was doing and what I was doing, and I thought to myself, there's just no way that I can keep doing this kind of work for another 30 or 40 years. It was just too boring, and most people might wonder, well, Joe, couldn't you figure that out when you're in college? Because most people think of accounting as quite boring. But I decided that rather than just abandon accounting altogether, that maybe I could use those financial skills to get into law enforcement. And so in the early 90s, I applied to the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the IRS Criminal Investigation Division to be what they call a special agent or criminal investigator, and actually proceeded first through the FBI gauntlet of evaluation and did very well. The only reason I didn't get hired by the FBI was that in the early 90s there was a hiring freeze, which prevented them from, you know, just appointing me to the position and sending me to Quantico, Virginia, to their academy. And in the meantime, while I was waiting for the FBI hiring freeze to be lifted, the IRS Criminal Investigation Division, an agency that I had also applied to, called me and said that they had a position open in the San Francisco office. I was born and raised in San Jose, which is about 50 miles to the south of San Francisco. And, you know, given that the FBI couldn't get that hiring authority and that I had waited already a couple of years to begin some kind of a law enforcement career, and also looking at the kind of work that the IRS did, of course, they dealt with tax and financial crimes. And, you know, certainly tax and accounting experience and financial experience were exactly what I possessed. So I thought, well, you know, it looks like maybe the best fit is the IRS, even though, you know, I'm not really that excited about working for the IRS. I mean, they don't exactly have the greatest reputation. But, you know, it looks like an interesting job, and why don't I give it a shot? So in November of 1993, I was actually sworn in as an IRS special agent, and IRS employees, just like every other government employee, are required to take an oath to support and defend the Constitution because the federal Constitution requires that each official take an oath. And, of course, that oath meant a great deal to me. Came to find out later, I guess it meant a lot more to me than all my coworkers. But nevertheless, it was a very important day for me to take an oath to support and defend the Constitution, and began working for the IRS in November of 1993. And after a couple of years, was confronted with some allegations, basically that I heard on a talk radio show, indicating that there was a significant problem with the IRS, the way that they administered and enforced the federal income tax. I normally would have considered such claims to be ridiculous, but the claims that were made by a talk show host and his guest, who had, you know, the talk show host had established some significant credibility with me over the prior 2 years. Basically, everything that he had said prior to that time was very truthful. So I thought, well, either he's decided to start telling lies or there's something to this claim about the income tax. But, you know, I thought, well, how could that be? Because if that's true what they say about the income tax, then what am I doing here with this, you know, Sig Sauer 9mm handgun and these handcuffs and all these tools that the IRS gave me to enforce these income tax laws? So that set me on about a two-year investigation off duty, you know, in my own time, while I still worked as an IRS criminal investigator, to get to the bottom of these claims about the federal income tax and whether or not it was actually being enforced and administered within the parameters of federal law. How am I doing? Still just keep going, or should I take a breath?
Well, yeah, one of our people in our chat, one of our listeners in our chat window, just put in, it says, Joe not being hired by the FBI was the best thing that happened for us. Thanks to you, Joe, for sticking your neck out and your commitment to revealing the truth. And I believe there's some real truth in that that comment. Joe, to give you a little bit of a breather on that, because I know you've told that story about yourself and you have had to explain who you are and where you came from, because a lot of people, you know, have obviously attacked you, especially those in the government circles have attacked you, even to the point of indicting you or attempting to. You know, I was really pleased to meet you at the Sheriff's Conference in Las Vegas. And before we launch off into to all of these other things about, you know, the tax issues, I'd kind of like to get a feel for what you brought or what you came away from that convention with, what that convention meant to you, what kind of reception you feel like you were getting there, and what do you think was gained by that?
Well, I'd say I left with a great deal of hope and excitement. You know, I've certainly, as I've said in my, when I do my speeches, and maybe most people are aware that, you know, I come from a family of law enforcement people. In fact, to this day, I mean, my brothers, two of the brothers are police officers, and one is a firefighter. And a couple, you know, the firefighter has progressed up to the level of battalion chief, and the brother, who's a California highway patrolman, has progressed up to lieutenant position. And I've got, you know, uncles and cousins and friends. And so, you know, I've certainly been exposed to a great deal of number of people in law enforcement. But it's really something to actually be at a convention with, you know, over 100 sheriffs, sheriff's deputies, police officers, and to actually have them be quite, you know, actually come and approach me after I spoke, because I thought, you know, I mean, I was enough of a, I didn't have any friends when I was in the IRS, and then even if you're former IRS, you tend to scare people away. But, you know, they were very gracious and had questions, and so anyway, I would say I'm extremely hopeful, especially because these sheriffs, I think they already, a lot of them at least that attended the conference, already knew what their duty is in terms of their oath to support and defend the Constitution, and that the, who they answer to are actually their own, the residents of the county in which they serve. And also just realizing the power that they have in their office, not realizing power as something to be abused, but just realizing the power is something that can be used to protect the citizens of their counties from federal bureaucrats who, frankly, in my experience, they don't know, these federal bureaucrats do not know the limitations to their authority. And they run around like a bunch of bulls in a china shop, laying waste to people's property and their freedom. And, you know, it's not fair that just because they're ignorant of the limits to their authority that people's lives should be ruined. And so I think it's just a phenomenal concept to be rejuvenating this awareness among the sheriffs of the country. And I'm hopeful that the association is going to grow by leaps and bounds. I think that, you know, certainly there were between 100 and 200 sheriffs there at this first convention, and I can only see the group growing because more and more sheriffs are going to realize that more and more of their constituents are being hammered by the federal government, wrongfully so, and there has to be an advocate, someone that will stand up and do something about it. A little concerned for the sheriffs, just in the sense of, you know, they already have a full-time job, just taking care of the the difficulties that are going on in their own counties, you know, and certainly this whole federal situation is going to add, you know, quite a few hours to their weekly schedule.
Well, one thing that I noticed, and I made this comment a couple of times since then, but what I observed was some very gentle spirits, some guys who were humble. I was really surprised that, you know, I didn't see people walking around with chips on their shoulder. I saw guys who were very, very courageous and caring people who were very approachable. And I didn't feel like any of the speakers that they had there, including yourself, were in any way looked at as though, you know, or even questioned. I really believe that these guys were there to understand their constitutional oath in a deeper level. And I felt that all the speakers really contributed to that. And I saw them, you know, you watch an audience, and I kind of sit back sometimes and watch their heads to see if they're, you know, taking a defensive posture or if their heads are moving left or right instead of up and down. And I was seeing guys, you know, enthusiastically embracing all of the messages, everything from Agenda 21 to property rights. And it's like you said, and even our listeners, you know, I did a broadcast there on that Monday night, and our listeners were literally writing in the chat room how this was the first time in a couple of years that they felt any hope, because everybody has become so hopeless, believing that this runaway government, that this, you know, this fascist group that's now controlling everything at the federal level, has taken over so much of our infrastructure and our institutions, including our courts, that it's just about, you know, to the point where people see it as insurmountable, that there's just no way to turn it around. And I keep mentioning that I believe that it's going to take divine intervention to do that, and we talk about that a lot here at Walls in Our Minds, and feel free to go there yourself. But I saw a group of men who were really down-to-earth people who cared about people and cared about the Constitution, and that did give me hope.
I couldn't agree more. I'm glad, you know, that you articulated it in that way, because that's exactly the experience that I had. And, of course, you know, I consider myself to be a humble person. I mean, we can always reach for more humility. There's never an end to that, you know. Certainly, the more we reach for humility, the less we'll be reaching for pride, because those are, you know, those don't fit together. Basically, one or the other. But you make a great point, because I think that having that quality, being humble men and women, will keep them focused on what their job is, and would keep any of us focused on what our job is. So seeing that kind of a demeanor was just very encouraging. You know, not that I would have expected anything different. I mean, take a look at Sheriff Richard Mack. You know, they just have a quality about them that it makes you feel at ease. Like even if they were put in a situation where there's a temptation to do something wrong, they wouldn't do anything wrong, even if no one was looking. So I totally agree with you that it's a great quality, and I think that's another thing that really confounds the tyrants that we're dealing with, is the demeanor of the person, the demeanor of the tyrant versus the demeanor of the humble servant, is easily recognizable by society. And so the tyrant just doesn't measure up. Their demeanor gives them away. And so you make a really great point.
Well, Joe, I've noticed that a lot of the best apologists out there, whether it's about Christianity or you know, whatever the topic may be, but the best apologists have come at this at their topic from an angle of proving it wrong, and then turning out to find out that it was right all along. And that seems to be what got you going. You started out with a zealous Paul, if you will, to prove that the IRS was a good thing and that it was lawful and that it was doing the right thing. And it's my understanding from the story I heard from you that people were raising doubts about that, and you didn't really appreciate that, and you were going to prove it right or wrong one way or the other, so you started digging into it. Can you maybe start there and take us forward?
Absolutely. I mean, you're right. I'd say the main reason that I wanted to prove it wrong wasn't so much out of a pride for myself, but just an expectation that, well, gee, I've been doing this job for quite a number of years. I've basically dedicated my entire professional life to the federal income tax system, both as a CPA representing clients before I went in the IRS, and then enforcing those tax laws while I served as a special agent. And it really concerned me when somebody was telling me, hey, this is really bad news. I mean, people's rights are being violated and their property is being stolen. And it was a pretty simple jump for me to realize that, well, if it's true that the IRS as an agency is stealing from people, in other words, taking their property without right or authority or permission, then if I'm part of that agency, then I'm part of that theft. I'm part of that wrongdoing. And I, my parents didn't, as I mentioned, they raised me to know the difference between right and wrong. And so it was really, I was, urged on just by my own conscience to put the issue to bed, to basically find out who's telling me the truth. Another motivation was that, as I mentioned, the talk show host had already built credibility with me over a couple-year period of being an avid listener to his talk radio show. And I thought, well, gee, I'm not a very good investigator if I thought this guy was on the level, and then I come to find out he's just a kook and, having kooky people on there talking about the income tax being a scam. So maybe I'm not that good of an investigator if this talk show host fooled me. So that was another motivation. It's like, well, the bottom line is I can't keep my head in the sand here. I've just got to find out who's telling the truth, and whoever's lying, I'm going to expose them, And at the very earliest stage, I thought, well, the people that have to be lying must be these people on the radio, because the rest of society, well, we all know that the income tax must be legitimate. I mean, certainly someone would have looked into this before now and arrived at that conclusion. But what I came to learn through my 2 years investigating while I still served as an agent, and of course have learned ever since then, is that there are plenty of people, Red Beckman for one, who have been beating the drum for decades about the truth, and then of course they get hammered by the IRS and the federal government for talking, why would they get hammered unless perhaps they were telling the truth? And that's what I came to find out as I looked more into these issues, that there were many people like Red Beckman, certainly one of the earliest, that's still saying the same thing, still singing the same tune, and their evidence is incontrovertible. I mean, the evidence that Red Beckman has accumulated over the years, or his joint venture with Bill Benson, and the list goes on and on with people who've gathered this evidence, and a lot of the evidence comes right out of the government's own mouth, their own documents. So, being an investigator, I found that the people that really had the most solid evidence and the most solid position were the very people that the government claimed were tax protesters and, anti-government zealots. And I found that, as you said about the sheriffs, they were actually quite sincere, and they weren't, drooling or, as I joke, knuckle-dragging mountain dwellers. They were just regular people who happened to find some evidence and were actually trying to share that evidence with their fellow Americans. And I didn't see anything wrong with that at all.
Well, there's been a lot of people that have heard your story and, you know, wonder, as they do, I mean, especially in the Patriot community, it seems like everyone is suspicious, and rightly so, when you learn that most of what you've been told all your life is a lie, it's hard to be any other way. But they question, you know, what your motives are. Are you controlled opposition? Or, you know, why haven't you come out and told people exactly how to beat this thing? You know, I hear that sort of thing from people. And, you know, when I first really learned about you in any kind of depth was at the Continental Congress in 2009 in Chicago, which you appeared by video. And it just seemed to me I saw a genuineness to you, and again a humble spirit again, and I compliment you for that. I you know, you're not somebody out there really you know, with a big ego. I don't see that. And but I'm kind of wanting you to be able to maybe share a little bit more something on a personal level here to let people understand who and what you are and what you're about. And then there's got to be certain things that you have to be really careful about. I mean, obviously, you were acquitted on the charges that they tried to stick you with. But still, I think you've got to be careful because, I mean, it's not going to do any of us any good for you or anybody else to land in jail. And we know that, you know, we've got a court system that can arbitrarily do that to people if that's what they want to do. So I'm not sure I've given you a specific enough question, but I kind of wanted to just kind of lay that ground and let you speak to it.
I think I pretty much could venture a try at responding to that. I've certainly been pretty I've always been concerned about what the IRS can and does do to people. So I've always refrained from, you know, pushing people in a direction or, you know, influencing them to take on the IRS. I've certainly always been willing to walk the walk myself, but if anything, I probably discourage people from, you know, taking on the IRS one-on-one. I mean, if their conscience is really pulling them to do so, you know, I would suggest that they really put all their ducks in a row in terms of their family and their, you know, if they own any property and those kinds of things, because it's an all-out war when you decide to tell the IRS that you're on to their scam. So I'm very careful about that, and even when I'm being careful not to influence people, it's still the IRS actually has always accused me of this, of being this Pied Piper that leads people down the road to all this stuff. And, you know, I guess I'm guilty as charged if by simply telling my story, it leads people to believe that the government, the IRS especially, and the federal government consists of a bunch of liars, a bunch of deceivers who are just out to rip people off and steal from them. And, you know, but I mean, I've always tried to stay with just telling my story of my own experiences and let people learn from those, from my experiences, as opposed to having to learn the hard way themselves. But of course, I also understand that, you know, everybody kind of has their line in the sand. Where people have had enough. And the thing is, I can't judge when that line in the sand occurs in each person's life. All I can do is, you know, tell the truth. When I'm invited to talk, as you've invited me here tonight, to simply let people know that, you know, I've kind of taken a stand myself, and maybe if they want to just learn by watching all the arrows that are shot into my back, you know, let me be the guinea pig kind of thing, or if they want to join in the fight. But, you know, I encourage people to educate themselves, take their time. As I mentioned, it took me a little over 2 years of part-time, off-duty research. I was still going to work every day as an IRS special agent, but I was, you know, I kept I kept plugging away. I kept pounding at the books and learning and learning and learning. And then there came a point when I realized, hey, I've done about as exhaustive an investigation as I can do, and I believe it's time that I go to my superiors at the IRS and say, hey, this is what I've found, and perhaps you can tell me, you know, where the error of my analysis is, if there is any error. But this is what I've come up with, and you guys, you know, trust me to carry this gun and badge around everywhere, even on airplanes. So, you know, I have some level of competency. I became a certified public accountant, you know, so the state of California thought that I was competent enough. And I've spent these last 2 years looking into these income tax issues, and it looks to me like there's something here, that the IRS is knowingly stealing from people, and, you know, taking their property, making wrongful assessments, and violating their rights. And that's how it looks to me. What do you think? And their answer, my superior's answer, was to hit the road, that we're not going to answer your questions, and, you know, here we'll gladly give you the paperwork to resign. And actually, the documentation, which, you know, is available on my website, shows exactly what their answer was, which was, we're not going to talk to you about this, and, you know, we don't care how many years you've invested here and what awards and promotions you've earned. You're not worthy of a response, and so might as well hit the road. So that's what I did.
Well, and now you've got a burden, and probably you feel a little bit between a rock and a hard place, I would imagine. I know I would, because you could be they could not be satisfied to leave you out there informing people or providing resources to people. What resources are out there for people to go after? What, you know, somebody that's not a CPA, somebody that's not with the IRS, where do you point them? Where do you direct them to learn more about this and to get educated enough that they can fight the battle if they choose to go that route?
Well, there's a website called whatistaxed.com. I haven't actually met the purveyor of that site, but what I do like about it is that it's a treasure trove of resources. And it's all free, and I don't think that, you know, the person on the site doesn't necessarily opine one way or the other about the income tax, but I'm sure you can basically tell by the way it's laid out that he or she has a lot of information that's, you know, there for the taking. Also, the truthattack.org, it's a group founded by attorney Tom Cryer, and it's made up of a bunch of different, you know, what we call tax honesty groups, and those are all available for viewing at truthattack.org. Truth Attack has what they call a pre-induction physical, which is kind of an interesting term, probably because Tom Cryer spent time in the military and thought it might be a good term to use, but it basically enables people to take a look at, you know, what would be involved if you end up taking on the IRS, and really kind of doing a little inventory of yourself and your life, and you know, I think it would give people a pretty clear picture of what might be involved, and you know, so you might check out the pre-induction physical on Truth Attack. Also, there's a really, really cool document that I had my hand in for many years in the making, but the IRS has this publication. It's called The Truth About Frivolous Tax Arguments, and Truth Attack has put together, and as I say, I had a hand in preparing, as did many others over the years, a rebuttal to this document. And I recently put out a little newsletter about that on my website, which, if I could give it out, you know, people could go and check it out, agentfortruth.com. I believe it's like, it was a January entry. It's in the last month or so. But it talks about this document, and people can download it and then review it for themselves. That would be another good resource, I think, to check into what the IRS is doing. Of course, you know, you can always go to irs.gov and see what they have to say. In my opinion, they're not truthful, but I think you should still evaluate what their position is. But I believe that when people take a look at what people in the so-called tax honesty movement are saying and what the government is saying, and the way they're saying it, it comes back to what you were saying earlier, Terry, that you can pretty much tell by the demeanor and the presentation whether someone's telling you the truth. And, I would never know. At some point in the future, the IRS could start telling the truth. But I haven't found that there's been any history of that. And I'm sure Red, you know, with the number of years that he's been at this, would say the same. So, you know, you always want to give people the benefit of the doubt. But I have yet to see the IRS act in a worthy manner with regard to this income tax issue. They seem to be more preferred to simply take out a bat and beat you over the head with it, and that's kind of the way they do business.
It's also equally important for people who are making that choice to not go down the wrong path. And I personally witnessed an awful lot of people who I call, they're basically seminar pirates. Some of which I really believe may be agent provocateurs. I've seen people come out with a silver bullet program that ended up with a lot of people going to jail. What can you add to that to give people a warning of maybe a little bit about what to stay away from?
Well, in terms of the silver bullet, I tell you, if I found one, I'd be just giving it away for free. But I have not seen the proverbial silver bullet when it comes to battling the IRS. I do agree that there's, you know, a lot of places out there where people can go, people go and find and end up getting in a lot of trouble. As a rule of thumb, I would just stay away from people or groups that say, if you pay me this money, you know, your IRS troubles are going to go away. I would look very cockeyed at anybody telling me that. And, of course, if they want some huge upfront fee, that's another reason that I would be, you know, I'd be very very careful to look at that. And you're right. I mean, a lot of people, they do get in trouble. I think the real trouble that we're all in is that we have a tax enforcement apparatus that is lying to us and has deep pockets, legions of lawyers, and about a half a century's track record of prosecuting people. So they have a well-oiled machine that's ready to grind you up. And so the trouble really comes from this out-of-control government. And people in New York or Chicago have to deal with the mafia. We all of us Americans have to deal with the federal government, and we have to be careful. And we have rights, and we have our property, and we have the rule of law. But you know, the federal government, in many ways, is ignoring those parameters. And so, the buyer has to beware, and, you have to decide, maybe I have to choose my battles, and these are the battles that I'm able to fight. Some people are equipped to fight the tax battle, other people aren't. But it doesn't mean that there aren't plenty of battles that you can still help with. That doesn't mean that there aren't ways you can help financially. Maybe you work in a career or a profession where, you really can't escape in terms of withholding and not filing and things like that. Maybe you can contribute a few bucks to the Constitutional Sheriff's Organization or, to your radio show or whoever. I mean, there's a lot of people that are struggling to make ends meet because they're out there trying to make a difference and trying to educate the public. So there's all kinds of ways that people can help, but I would say generally, if you are a what they call a W-2 worker, where you get a W-2 from a company or you work for a government agency, you're really the last group, the last person that should try to stop filing and paying, because the IRS, you know, really has you between a rock and a hard place, and you know, you're not going to have much success, if any, if you try to take on the IRS. Now, other people who have their own business or things like that, they may have a little more flexibility and may feel like they can give that a try. But really, any of us, we all have to watch our step. There's a minefield out there, and as I found, as you kind of alluded to with my this criminal prosecution, I thought I was absolutely on safe ground, because the work that I did for this particular client, I followed the IRS rulebook to the letter. And for that, I got prosecuted. So you really can never be too careful.
Joe, are you okay if we open the phone lines up a little bit and take a question or two? I've got a specific question from a listener that asked me ahead before the show to inquire about one subject, but we've got one caller right now online that would like to ask a question, if that's okay.
Sure.
Area code 931, you have a live mic. Let us know who you are.
Hi, my name is Paul. I'm a former law enforcement officer, and I just want to make sure that you can hear me.
Yes, sir, hear you fine.
Being a law enforcement officer, former law enforcement officer, both in the Department of Corrections and within the Sheriff's Department, my question is directed toward Joe, excuse me, because he is also basically a former law enforcement officer. What I'm seeing today, and one of the reasons why I had to resign, is because I'm seeing the entity of government, both locally and federally, using an immoral and corrupt organizations like Sheriff's Department to implement their rule or in their unlawful acts. My question to Joe is, you claim to be an investigator, which you are, and in my opinion, all law enforcement officers need to be an investigator. When you went into the service, did you not see immediately that there was contradictions of something as simple as the right not to incriminate yourself by signing the tax return? And if you hadn't, why would we expect all of these other ignorant people that are in law enforcement to see the same thing?
It's an excellent question. I think I can address it to your satisfaction. Basically, and you may have had this experience yourself, but when you go through training, and for me, as I mentioned, there was a number of years that I worked outside of the IRS in the private sector. And we all, I think you would agree, we're susceptible to the level of training that we're given. So, for example, when I went to San Jose State University and got an accounting degree, one of the required classes was an introduction to federal income taxation. Well, when you look at the textbook and you look at the curriculum of that class, they maybe spend an hour, maybe even like a half an hour or 10 minutes on the history of the federal income tax. Then they jump right into what's deductible, you know, how do you fill out a tax return, things like that. So they completely gloss over, and I would submit that it's a purposeful gloss over, not by the professor in the class, but in who creates the textbooks and the overall curriculum. They don't want to tell you the truth. So whether you take my tax class or you take the CPA exam or you take the IRS training that I went through, your knowledge is only going to be as good as your training. And so I have to say that with all the training that I had, for example, the issue of Fifth Amendment issues with regard to tax returns, it wasn't ever framed in that manner. in my training. Once I began to do the research prior to leaving the IRS, and that concept was framed in that manner, where, you know, they would say, well, hey, Joe, did you ever consider that when you were a special agent and you went out to talk to someone, especially if they were under investigation, you'd have to read them their Miranda rights and say, you don't have to talk to me. Isn't that true, Joe? And I would say, well, yes, of course it is. Well, did you ever consider that a tax return is testimony? And how is it that the person that you talk to in an interview doesn't have to talk to you, but the tax return filer does? And I thought to myself, well, absolutely. But it wasn't until it was framed in that manner that the lights went on. So, and I mean, that happened over and over and over again, because as I went through my training, at, whether it be at San Jose State or training for the CPA exam or the IRS, it's framed with only certain questions that are posited to the student. So does that make sense?
I totally agree with you, and that's the way the police academies were set up and when I went through. But I almost got thrown out of all, you know, both academies that I attended because I questioned what they were, what they're teaching. You know, like this, you know, that totally contradicts what I was taught as a young child. You can't just go in there and search a vehicle without a warrant, without probable cause. And literally, they would take me outside and tell me to stop speaking in front of the class. I said, I'm not going to stop speaking because you're not going to continue spreading this propaganda that the Constitution no longer applies. And even in these classes, they would say, they would laugh at me and say that the Constitution is not law. They go, like, what do you think the Constitution is? I said, the supreme law of the land. And they're like, do you think it's law? And they would laugh. So here's my concern. If these uneducated, ignorant people are going into law enforcement and it becoming a part of an immoral and corrupt system, that's what, you know, I understand, and I don't get me wrong, I love the constitutional sheriffs. But what are we to do? The only thing I can think of is that we need to join locally in order to stop this.
Well, you're absolutely right, and that's why I you know, we all on the show here, the hosts and myself, and the ones that were at the sheriff's convention, have some hope, is that there, it's not like we're having to create a system where this can take place. The system's already there. It's just that these administrators, these sheriffs, the office is occupied by people that, like as you described, are laughing at those who say the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. But they're not all laughing. There is a core, a remnant of administrators who get it. And they get it so much that they tell that to all their deputies. And all we can do, I mean, you know, look at slavery, look at smoking. And I mean, I'm not against smokers. If you know, I think we should have the freedom to smoke. But I'm just saying, as a societal change, you know, when slavery was around, there was a lot higher percentage of the population that accepted it as okay. Well, what's the percentage today that would think that slavery is okay? Not very much. And so over time, people have changed. They've gotten more aware with smoking. You know, again, smokers can smoke if they like. I have no problem with it. But more and more people have stopped smoking. They just don't want to smoke. And why did that happen? It's because, you know, throughout time, The concept has been posed to them, hey, do you think you'd be better off if you didn't smoke? And more people are saying, yes, I think so. So I really have hope that over time we need to hang on, you know, people like yourself. You know, my brothers are still in law enforcement. I had to resign because I really couldn't function. I couldn't, like, go to a section of the IRS where they weren't screwing people. I mean, it's right. Pretty much pervasive. You know, like, there's certain excise taxes that the IRS does collect, and probably if I got into that little area, maybe I could be protected from, you know, cheating people. But then I thought, I won't be able to speak as widely and let people know about, you know, the 98% of the IRS that is cheating people. So I had to make a decision that, you know, basically I can do better, I can support and defend the Constitution, I could adhere to my oath actually better by resigning than I could by staying with this agency.
Well, you speak of the oath that we all took, and I took it when I was also in the Marine Corps. But here's something that's very disturbing. I can, you know, I constantly preach that the, even before I found out about everything that you guys are talking about, the constitutional sheriffs and so forth, I constantly preach that the answer to restoring our local liberties through the county sheriff. We need a badge against a badge. However, if you go to any American and ask them this question, can anyone legally force you to sign a contract or document? They all say no. But when you ask for, okay, then what about traffic citations, you know, tax returns, the selective service for males, marriage licenses, driver's licenses, and you, the list goes on to about six or seven. But when I specifically talk about tax returns, they're like, oh, well, no, I don't have to sign that. What do you mean you don't have to sign it? Or have you ever sent in a return and not signed it? They'll send it back to you. And these people know this. They immediately, without missing a heartbeat, they know that no one can legally force them to sign anything, but at the same time, they disregard. Why is it that all of these documents, these six or seven documents, always overlook, but everything else is in play?
Well, I mean, my comment to that is just that I hear your frustration, and maybe I just don't sound as frustrated, but I'm you know, just as frustrated. But you know, that's kind of we live here in 2012, and we're thrust into this position where we are a small remnant. But you know what? Small remnants have done incredible things. There's a small remnant of Christians. And there was a big power of Rome, and the Christians are still here, and the empire of Rome is gone. So, you know, we just happen to live at a time when it looks pretty bleak, but all I can do is what I can do, and, you know, I'm disappointed that more IRS agents didn't follow me out the door. I mean, it's just not rocket science, these issues.
There's a question. How do you know they didn't? I mean, just because they didn't have the courage you had to face the bureaucracy, if you will, if we can call it that. I think it's worse than that, but for not wanting to call it something worse. How do you know a lot of people didn't walk? How do we know how many left without the courage to speak up?
Well, I mean, you make a good point, and I do know of a few that I'm pretty certain left the agency, and they basically went to other agencies, including the Homeland Security. So, you know, but for whatever reason, their conscience couldn't take staying with the IRS. So, you know, it's a little bit better than nothing. So, no, you're right. And when I say it followed me out the door, I guess I mean in the manner I did, in the sense of, you know, really speaking up. But yeah, you never know. And of course, maybe there'll be a delayed reaction. I understand from pretty credible sources that a lot of the agents that I used to work with, especially after I got prosecuted and then was acquitted, you know, I think the basic gist of their belief, you know, to read their minds, is that they might have questioned, like, gee, I thought Joe was a pretty with-it guy, and then he goes and joins all these tax protesters. But then when they saw the way I was prosecuted and they saw, you know, the trial transcripts and saw that the government had absolutely no evidence of any wrongdoing but prosecuted me anyway, I think, you know, over time they've realized that, wow, you know, maybe Bannister was telling the truth and they just want to shut him up. And so even though they're not, they don't have the courage to speak up themselves, I think they still have a brain, you know, that works, and they can see, as I was saying before, as Terry noticed, the demeanor, the presentation, you can tell when someone is speaking from the heart, and these things truly matter to them, or they're just somebody that's going through the motions and could care less. And, you know, I think ultimately all we can do is try to keep our cool, try to be patient, and try to realize that, you know, some people are around, you know, some people were around in 1789 when we actually got a constitution and we hit the road and we were running, you know. But some died in 1777, you know, and they never saw that, but yet they worked really hard for it. So I don't really get too worked up about the results. All I try to do is do my best with the, you know, tools that God gave me, and, you know, try to exercise patience and do my best. But, you know, it is very frustrating, but it's also fun. It's kind of fun. I mean, I feel it as Paul, that who cares if they laugh at you, you know? Look at the people that have become Ron Paul supporters just since 2008. Because
I agree with you. When the instructors would laugh at me, I would gain the entire class with support and people. And I was handing out DVDs of American Freedom to Fascism right there in the academy. But the problem that I'm kind of concerned with is, and please don't take this the wrong way, because, you know, I'm a Christian just like the next Christian. And I'm a biblical person just like the next biblical person. But I'm seeing, and you tell me if you disagree with me, I am seeing people who claim to be Christian that are not Christian in any fashion, and that they are also, they're allowing their religion to control them to the point, and I'm going to prove this. Well, I can't prove it to you. I'm just going to tell you a little story. I had a technician that I was dealing with, and we were speaking about these issues, and he's like, oh, yeah, you're correct, but it doesn't matter, because they can take all my clothes and chain me up to that tree over there in the dead of winter, and I can die. I know I'm going to a better place. But he's not willing to stand up and protect his life, liberty, or property?
Again, I agree, and I've seen it. Isn't it said in Deuteronomy to first do justice? I mean,
right.
You know,
that's why I make the claim that people claim to be Christian, because they're not reading Scripture. They even say to me that they don't need to because their pastors is what. Whoa. So their pastors is what they're telling you what's the Scripture's about. You're not even taking the initiative to understand it for yourself.
Well,
this is what we're surrounded by, Joe.
Well, Paul, can I interject for a second, Joe?
Sure, absolutely.
We don't in the Patriot movement, there are those who won't even allow the word God to be mentioned in a conversation. Because they're afraid that somehow that's going to create an exclusive environment and drive somebody away. And that's not the only reason they say it, but it's one of the reasons. And here at Walls in Our Minds, we have on many occasions, and I know Red right now, when you started mentioning Deuteronomy, he could start quoting it and bringing out a number of issues, but I don't want to spend the rest of the show on that topic right now, but it certainly could. We could easily do a whole show on this, because the fact of the matter is that we are in a huge, huge spiritual battle. At the very root of all of this is a spiritual battle. These people, their intent that are behind all of this, these international banksters, some call them elite, some call them Illuminati, some call them, you know, they've got all kinds of different names, Bilderberg Group, Club of Rome, Club of 300, I mean, you could, CFR, you know, the IRS is even a part of that. So, I mean, this is a spiritual situation. These people don't just want a one-world government. They want a one-world religion, and they want to be worshipped like gods. And anybody that doesn't understand that really doesn't see the big picture about what's going on, because they have used the fact that they stepped in and fraudulently grasped hold of the ability to control the currency or the money of this country. They use that to steal our production. They use that to siphon off. I call it a banking taxing vortex. But what that group does is they're controlling the whole society, because they want to rule. They believe that they can can spend our money and rule better than the collective can. And when I say that, I'm talking about the individuals in a republic. But this is a huge spiritual battle. These people are truly Luciferians. And when that information sinks into somebody, it changes their whole perspective about what's going on. We've got to gain back our control of our money. We've got to take this banking taxing vortex, and we have got to disrupt it, and we've got to restore sound banking. We've got to take proprietary ownership of our money, and we have to do it with God's help, because God told us, just like Red has brought out many times, he told us to subdue. He told us to be good stewards. And what we have done is we have abdicated our stewardship of our own production to a bunch of Luciferians. And that's as plainly as I can make it. Paul, I just want to thank you for contributing to the conversation tonight. We do need to move on to some other questions and some other topics, but I do want to give you, Joe, an opportunity to respond to what I just said.
We're very much in agreement, and it is a spiritual battle. Ultimately, I think that's part of why I've been able to survive and thrive is just realizing that, you know, God has a will, and his will be done, and we are simply to carry out that will. At least that, you know, I think that's the way a Christian would look at it. And so I'm comfortable with not needing to know everything or, you know, see results of all my efforts, but just realize that it is a spiritual battle, first and foremost. And
Red's been awfully quiet. I'd like to make sure he knows he can jump in here. Red, I know that you've got something on your mind after what we just said.
Well, I really don't need to say anything. I think you've been saying it pretty well. I really believe that an awareness. We have more of an awareness today of the spiritual end of this thing, as we've got millions of people that are losing their homes and they have no jobs, and they're looking for answers. What happened to our system? What's wrong with our system that we have deteriorated to this point? And that's one of the values of programs such as this, because we can try to give them some answers as to why we're in the situation we're in. When you've got a government that lies, my friend Pat Shannon with America Free Press wrote that book. There's another volume coming before long. Everything they ever told me was a lie. Now, that's a lie is, there's something very, very spiritual about a lie. It's a sin to lie. We're supposed to learn that at our mother's knee, that lying is a sin, and that there is a price to pay. When people lie, they have a judgment day assigned to them at some point. But also, those of us that are being damaged, we see other people being damaged by these lies. We have a responsibility. And you won't find many of the religious leaders in this country that would speak out like this and say, we have to stop this lying government. We've got to make this government tell us the truth. And you won't hear that from our pulpits in this country. And we're paying a very high price for that right now. But I am encouraged. I see some things happening that are definitely something different than what we were hearing in the not too distant past. And so when people get hammered themselves individually, they have to start thinking for themselves. And that's what's happening. And I just hope that it all this backfires on the scoundrels that have took over our political system. I tell people, and I don't think there's too many people that'll argue with me, that religions, the different religions and such, have caused more political problems on planet Earth than anything else. The religions that are being taught and such have generated a lot of political error, created many deaths and misery in the way of wars and all of that. And so I like what we're hearing tonight, and we need to hear more of it. And my hat is off to Joe, because he does understand what you're saying when you talk about the Luciferian influence that we have. And I didn't have to say it. I'm glad of that. Somebody else. And, of course, as I have said many, many times on this program, back in 1975, I was pretty lonesome on my soapbox, but I'm not lonesome anymore. We need more Joe Bannisters and more Terry Dodds and others, and they're coming, and it's happening, and I'm just thrilled to death by it. So I'll be quiet for a bit.
Thanks, Red. Joe, can we shift gears for a second?
Sure.
The question that was given to me before the show was pertaining to windfall profits. The question was, what does the code say about windfall profits? And I really believe that this is a group of patriots who are wanting to know really how to defend themselves against a claim of windfall profits, let's say. And they'd like to hear what you're willing to share on that.
Well, I'm going to be disappointing them, because I've certainly heard of windfall profits, but I'd say in my 25 years of, you know, working with tax issues, I don't think I've ever been given an assignment to even look into windfall profits. And I mean, it's certainly a complex area, but I just have no knowledge about that area of taxation. So I'm going to have to pass on that. I just you've stumped me. I have no idea about windfall profits.
Okay, well, that's fair. That's an honest answer, and that's all anybody can ask. When I heard the question originally, I thought it might have been pertaining to a gain from currency transactions, because, you know, the patriot community, there are some of them out there in the assemblies, for example, who have, for example, I'm not saying this is what this question was about specifically, but that had acquired Iraqi dinars, for example. And I would think that if you're in a position where you have to report something like that, that the code would consider that ordinary income. So am I wrong in that regard?
Well, you know, if we're just talking in general terms, what I've always found interesting, and I've bounced this off some of the attorneys in the tax movement, is that even if you, a person, American, has income, I mean, something that would fit the constitutional definition of income, is there anywhere in the Internal Revenue Code that makes you liable to pay a tax on it? And, you know, those that I've bounced off the question to agree that no. I mean, there's still the limited circumstances in the Internal Revenue Code where an American could be made liable to pay the federal income tax. And that's in the 1400 sections relating to withholding, being a withholding agent on payments to foreign corporations and non-resident aliens. So, really all I can do is offer that general analysis that no matter what kind of income you might end up earning, there's still the question of liability. And, of course, the IRS, even in their own publications, admits that you have to file a tax return for any tax you are liable for. And, in fact, you also only have to keep the books and records for a tax that you're liable for. So if you happen to come across some income, a constitutionally defined income, still, where do you become liable for paying a tax on that income? That's something that I would certainly look at if that situation applied to me. So I don't think I can really address per se if somebody had a gain from buying and selling Iraqi dinars, whether that would mean they were taxable or not. But again, I'd be looking at, is this income as the Constitution defines it? And then, am I liable to pay a tax on it? If I'm liable, well, what statute makes me liable? Where in the Internal Revenue Code, in Subtitle A, which deals with income tax, am I liable to pay a tax on this income?
Well, that comes back to a good question. I've tried to do a little research on what the constitutional definition of income is, and it seems that the consistent consensus that I've seen is that if it's non-government paid employment wages or wages for labor, if it's not paid by the government, that does not qualify as income by the constitutional definition. Am I wrong in that?
No, you're not wrong. And in fact, there's numerous Supreme Court cases that indicate that you're correct. Now, this is also where I would suggest if people went to truthattack.org, there's actually a law library and various other resources there where they get into this discussion about exactly what income is. And actually, earlier in the show when I mentioned at agentfortruth.com, that recent posting that I did, I actually, frivolous tax arguments rebuttal also addresses the question of what is income. I really would encourage people to go there because I don't know how detailed we can get in this discussion. But when you talk about how the IRS gets away with treating, let's say I go out and work for 8 hours of pay, and I expend 8 hours of my time, which, according to the Supreme Court, my time is my property, and I get, $20 an hour, so they give me $160, and so I've traded 8 hours of my time at $20 an hour for $160. And the way that the IRS treats that transaction as a gain is because the IRS says that my basis, my value in that 8 hours that I spent is zero. It has no value. Now, if I was working for someone else and spent that 8 hours of time, that someone else who billed out my time, who hired me out to someone else, the cost, the basis, the value of my time would be magically $160. So, incredibly, the IRS, which is because it goes to show you the double standard and how much they are absolutely lying about this issue, if you're working for yourself, the value of your property, your time, your 8 hours of labor is zero. But if you're working for someone else, magically, the value is the time, is the amount you were paid. So there is no gain, but the way the IRS treats it as if there was a gain is they put zero value on your basis, on the value of the time you put into the project. And that's, of course, outrageous because they don't do that. The IRS doesn't do that in any other circumstance. They only do it when it's you trading your time for money. And it just goes to show the ridiculousness of, you know, how the IRS treats these transactions, you know, and treats them as taxable when they're not. There is no gain. There is no income. But the IRS, you know, tells you there is, and they have to lie to you about the way they calculated the gain.
Joe, we've got about a half an hour left. Kurt, I know you're in the background there. If you've got any particular questions, or Kate, or Dr. or Red, if you've any of you guys want to bring any questions forward here, feel free to please jump in. Let's see.
I certainly have ask questions.
Go ahead.
Sure, Kurt.
Yeah, hi, Joe. This is Kirk McKenzie.
How you doing, Kirk?
I am enjoying your conversation tonight. Of course, I could ask tons of detailed questions, but that's probably not the purpose of the show tonight. The one thing I would say, if I can, I'll just make a comment. I've been kicking this ball around for a long time and trying to figure out where we can get traction and where things we can make a difference. And I've been out there consistently putting out things like the C3 project where we communicate, coordinate, and cooperate. I think there's a lot more that we can do when there's synergy, and it's difficult to get that, but I think there's a ton more that will happen once that begins to happen, like we're seeing with the sheriff's event now. The conclusion that I've reached is that where that remnant exists and where it can actually be nurtured and grow, in my opinion, is going to be in rural America. I think, Joe, when I talked to Sheriff Mack at an event that he presented at and I presented at a few months ago, I asked the question, you know, how many of the sheriffs come from rural America? And his immediate answer was 100%. And then he kind of backed up and said, well, you know, that's not exactly true, but, you know, 95% or more. And I believe that's really the case. And I think the places like trying to battle this in San Francisco Bay are going to be pretty hard to do. I really believe that the fight is going to have to be fought in the rural states and then in those states and the rural communities itself. These communities, let me back up. I think we have to be very practical in the way we pursue things. You know, the deck of cards is on the table. I think we have to take what's there, and we've got to make it work from where it is. These people are facing real issues, and although some would like to call it Agenda 21, I don't think that's the way that most of these people view it. They view it as, you know, water rights and, you know, mining rights and trees and the Endangered Species Act and so forth. I think we have to join that battle, and I think in the process of joining that battle, we can. These people are coming along pretty quickly, as are the sheriffs, in learning more about this, the bigger part of the picture, and I think that's where the renaissance, if you will, the restoration can begin and grow. Any thoughts?
I'd agree. I mean, I think in terms of focus, that's going to be the audience that's going to react the most rapidly and the most fervently to the message. But I think we should also keep pounding on the city centers, you know, on the urban areas too, because most of the bureaucrats that are going to be banging on the doors of rural America are going to come from the urban centers. So, I don't know where can we start, because we need to fight everywhere, but. You know, I would consider that the foot soldiers for the battles in rural America are going to come from the urban centers. So, I'd keep up the pace in the urban centers as well. And you might find that in the urban centers, the message would actually be transmitted more rapidly because of the, you know, close proximity that people live to each other. So I agree that, you know, the main audience that's going to be the most receptive and work the hardest and maybe have more time to devote because, you know, frankly, I live in a more rural area than I used to, And I can see that, you know, you actually have a few minutes to breathe in the rural areas. So, you know, that's where a lot of the activists are going to come from. But ultimately, I'd keep the message being pounded into the urban areas as much as possible. And, of course, with the Internet, you can, you know, you can do it with both. So
my feeling is that the, and then it's not an all-in-one message, but I believe that, follow the, let me just develop the logic and get your reflection, and then I'll drop off on this. I think that we have essentially somewhere around 30, north of 30 states that are rural states predominantly. They're in one level of revolt or another against the federal government, looking to bring back silver, you know, trying to get control over public lands and who you know, has jurisdiction over those. Passing, you know, resolutions against the NDAA. It seems to me that we have, within the rural states, we have approximately two-thirds. You know, rural states may not have a lot of population, but they have two senators. We have approximately two-thirds of the states are in rural states. And I believe that with a little bit of push and shove, we get awfully close to three-quarters. My personal opinion is that we could have a, you know, clarify some things in the Constitution, whether it's by amendment or not, like define the word commerce and make tremendous progress. And that can be done, in my opinion, with three-quarters ratification of the states without even going through the government or without a con-con. I think that the states themselves created the Constitution. They created the federal government. The people did. And we can change it. And I believe that's a process to do that. And I think it's the rural states where that will be able to happen. I think the chances of getting California or New York or Florida are about zero.
No, I agree. And I think I see what you're saying in terms of, you know, actually implementing, you know, actual laws, whether it be, you know, constitutional amendments to state constitutions or just, you know, the actual practices, you know, courts and laws that are passed in these states where you can actually have a prayer of getting it done, you know, like in a reasonable amount of time, a few years. Whereas in California, yeah, you're basically people just aren't interested and they're going to just, you know, destroy themselves and they're going to reap what they sow. But meanwhile, the two-thirds of the states that you're describing will actually be an example, you know. And in fact, when these urban centers disintegrate, they're probably going to want to come to the the rural states who are still standing because they've actually done things right. So I see what you're saying and would totally agree that that's where the resources should be applied. But just keep an eye out because those urban centers are going to have a lot of people that are going to come over the mountains, and you want to be ready for them.
Well, I know that Dr. Kate, as well as Red Beckman, had something to say or question, but we do have one more caller that I want to get in before going to Red and Kate. Area code 478, you have a live mic. Please let us know who you are.
Hello, brother. This is Randall.
Hello there.
Hey, brother. How you doing?
I'm doing great. This is my brother, Randall Dodd, in Georgia.
Terry, my question is, you know, I've listened to a number of your programs, and I know that Red Beckman and a group he's worked with for a long period of time has gone to all the states and gathered all the certified documentation on the falsification of the 16th Amendment, and I just wonder where they stand on that. Have they got all the information they needed and what they intend to do with it?
Well, first of all, before I let Red answer that, because I know Red's going to want to respond to that, in the state of Georgia, you are in a rare situation there in Georgia, Randall, because they put forth what they call a memorial petition. The state actually issued a memorial petition in Georgia stating, for example, that the 14th Amendment was never properly ratified. And that's a rare situation because it really opens up the can of worms about the fact that these amendments, the 14th, 15th, 16th, and 17th, have all been fraudulently ratified. That memorial petition on the 14th Amendment became law in 2007 because they issued that in 1957. And after 50 years, if a memorial petition from a state has not been responded to by the federal government, it becomes law. Well, that's really a can of worms, because that really shows that that at least one amendment in the state of Georgia has been declared not properly ratified, and it is in fact law. Now, Red, you want to talk a little bit more about the law that never was? And by the way, Randall, I've got the book that Red put out called The Law That Never Was. It's a hardback book that's got certified documents from the 48 states that proves that it was not lawfully ratified, and I'll be glad to mail you a copy of that that book so that you'll have it down there. Red, you want to comment?
I'd be more than happy to give a long speech on that, I guess. I'm going to read a section of our U.S. Criminal Code, Title 18, Section 4, which says this: whoever, having knowledge of the actual commission of a felony cognizable by a court of the United States, conceals and does not as soon as possible make known the same to some judge or other person in civil or military authority under the United States, shall be fined not more than $500 or imprisoned not more than 3 years or both. Now, you know, it says whoever having the knowledge of an actual commission of a felony. I have the knowledge. I have the documentation to prove that there's been a felony, because there has been tampering with our Constitution. You see, this is what it amounts to when they put a fraudulent amendment in as an amendment to the Constitution. That was an attack on the Constitution, and everybody that was involved had all taken an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution from enemies, foreign and domestic. Now, this is domestic enemies that we're dealing with here. Now, every federal judge in the United States of America, there's over 1,000 of them, that includes the 9 justices of the U.S. Supreme Court and all of the lower courts. Now, that's quite a few people. Every one of the U.S. attorneys and the federal prosecutors that are prosecuting tax cases, every one of them is on notice of the fraud that we have the documentation to prove. They have not come up. Now, we published this hardcover book in April of 1985. We have not had one single time, and this has been tried to get this. We've tried to get this before grand juries and petit juries, criminal juries considering criminal charges by the IRS. We've never been able to get in all these years, over 25 years, it's 27 years now, that we've been trying to get this information into a court of law to get a decision out of the court. And they have roadblocked us. They have done everything. And, of course, we can go on now, and we can name several more sections, like the section in the criminal code about obstruction of justice. Every federal judge in this country belongs in jail. Now, that's quite a mouthful that I have said, but I know what I'm talking about. I put our senior federal judge in Montana, I put him on notice of the 16th Amendment fraud in the early 1980s, before this book came out, because we already knew in the fall of 1980. I put him on notice of the fact, because the law required me. You see, I am in compliance with this law. whoever having knowledge of the actual commission of a felony cognizable by a court of the United States conceals or does not as soon as possible make known the same to some judge. I am in compliance with that statute. Every federal judge is in violation of that statute. Every U.S. attorney and federal prosecutor is aware of that, and they're all in the same boat. They're all felons. And so
but are they all aware
of the justice system? Why?
Are they all aware of the notification?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No ifs, ands, or buts, because we know about their communication system in the judiciary, between the judges, between the courts. They have their three times a year, I think it is, that the federal judges all get together in their appellate court district and discuss all of the information, all of the cases and such that need their attention. And so they know, and of course, excuse me, that video that the gentleman from former law enforcement, he was saying how that they had shown a program, what was the name of that program that he mentioned? I can't think of it. It was all over the country. Everybody has watched that. The Law That Never Was, that book, was shown on the beginning of that video. And, you see, it's been out there. I've been on hundreds of talk shows. And it's been written up in many, many a book, and there's no excuse. So what does this tell us? It tells us that we have a case where these people are so sure that they can get away with this criminal activity. They can get away with it because we, the people of this country, aren't doing our job of maintaining control of our servants, our public servants. And, of course, we're hearing quite a bit about sovereignty in the state legislatures and such. Well, we're talking about sovereignty here. When I say that we the people have a responsibility to bring these people to, you know, to judgment, we've got to prosecute these people, and it's going to take a grand jury, or grand juries, I should say, made up of we the people that have enough smarts, have enough knowledge to where we can take these questions up, examine the evidence, and file charges against these people that are in clear violation of the law. And until that happens, nothing great is going to happen for this country, I don't think, except that the federal government is in a situation where they're self-destructing. And that's probably going to happen before we get a grand jury that will accept the responsibility of going after these lawbreakers. It's a criminal syndicate that we're involved with and having to put up with. And someone brought up the spiritual aspect. When people in the Internal Revenue Service, the people that worked with Joe in the service, and when they didn't follow Joe out of the building, they had a spiritual problem, because they were not willing to stand up for what was right. And that is a spiritual problem.
Well, Red, my question has been now, and as it's been for years, where do we go from here? What do we do to get something really going? I want a copy of the book that you got, that y'all produced in, what was it, say, 1985? I'd like to know more about the law that was passed over 50 years ago in Georgia. I have a lot of state representatives that are personal friends of mine that I believe I could get us an audience through them. And I'd like to try to do something about it. I'm one of these type of people, I don't believe in talking about something. I'm a believer, and you find a way and you do it, some way you got to get something going. You can, you know, you sit back and talk about things for the next 50 years, and nothing will be done. Somebody has to put together something to get it started and get something moving. And
I've been doing it for 37 years, and we see some things happening, but we need a lot more. We've got a nation that is being governed by a criminal syndicate, and we need to get something done to correct that situation.
Well, I think now is probably one of the better times that we'll ever have to bring things out in the open, at least. And whether it be on a national TV show or whatever it takes to get it out to the public, I'm sure that 99.9% of the public is probably not even aware.
I agree wholeheartedly, but they're paying the price for that in their home foreclosures and all of that. They're paying for that failure on their part to be better informed. Now, let me say this. There is a light at the end of the tunnel, and I don't think it's a freight train. Our Constitution is still there, but there's one part of our Bill of Rights that we got sidetracked, and we haven't really accepted the responsibility that goes with it, and it's the 7th article of the Bill of Rights, the common law courts. And this is something, Joe, if you want to call me, I will explain to you what has happened. We have put a real monkey wrench in the works for the tax courts and such with this, and it's something. It's the 7th Amendment. Let me say it this way: the 7th Amendment, 7th article of the Bill of Rights, is without a doubt the most powerful and the most unused part of our Bill of Rights. It is far more important than the 1st, the 4th, and the 5th Amendments that are so much the darling of the civil libertarians. And so, number 7. God's number. It's the key to a lot of the things that have to happen. And so I'll shut up. We're running out of time.
Randall, it sure was great to have you call in, brother.
Well,
I
it's
hope you do
good
this,
to hear all this.
Do this more often.
Well, I'm glad to know that y'all are still working the way you're doing. And I just, as I've told you in the past, you know, I'm not one to sit around and just say, well, let's keep talking about it. I'm one to try to find a group to get together and do something about it.
I've never been one to sit back. I want
to
ask Joe a question on your behalf because I'm betting you'll want me to ask it. Joe, what is your opinion of the fair tax?
I'm not very thrilled with the concept. One of the benefits that is touted about the fair tax is that somehow it's going to capture, shall we say, all the taxable objects. It'll reduce fraud and things like that. I actually think the opposite will occur, because when you put a significant premium on goods, there's going to be a humongous incentive to then create a black market so that the people can, criminals can basically make that margin for themselves rather than pass it on to the government. A sample would be like the fuel excise tax. It's quite common in the IRS to have to investigate criminal activity that goes on with the fuel excise tax or diesel fuel. And the reason is that same kind of concept where there's a premium added to the fuel. It's a tax, an excise tax. And I think that similar kind of concept would be applied with the fair tax, where they're going to add a premium, a tax, to taxable objects. And I just think it's going to make a huge market for fraud. The other thing I'm concerned about with the fair tax is I think that they would probably try to tax a lot more items than constitutionally they'd actually have the power to tax. And I think that, you know, most of the people that are touting the fair tax don't recognize or don't like to talk about how many items that they try to tax that wouldn't even, you know, they wouldn't even have the constitutional authority to do so. So,
you know, I was kind of for the fair tax when it first came out until I really started looking into it. And it's the biggest thing is about the fair tax, a lot of the calculations they make are based on false assumptions. It passes by doing away with the payroll taxes. It passes all of the tax away from the lower class all to the middle and upper class. You got 50% of the people in the United States now paying no income tax. They are, however, if they're working, paying the payroll taxes. But if it passed the fair tax, as it's currently written, their effective tax liability after rebate drops down to about 1%. And, you know, it's one thing to not pay any income tax at all to help run this country that you're benefiting from. It's another thing to want all the people, that 50% of the people, to pay for your retirement also. So there's a lot of things I think that's negative.
Let's jump past this question about the income tax as it is today, the tax code, the flat tax, which is just another form of an unconstitutional, unapportioned tax. The fair tax may be, you know, more constitutional, but let's jump past all of that and ask this question. Is the income tax of any kind necessary? And is it, how do you operate a government on a tax system when the government itself is totally operating outside of the authority of the Constitution? I'll lay that one on you, and you got about 4 minutes left, Joe.
Well, I agree with what you're saying. The only thing about the fair tax, if they were to pass it, they would have to pass a constitutional amendment in order to make it work. There would have to be other things passed with it as far as a budget, as far as the federal government, as far as a maximum budget being maybe no more than 18% of GDP. But really, if you leave the Social Security and Medicare as is, it could drop down to as little as maybe 12% of GDP. There's a lot of things that would need to be looked at. And the way it's written right now, anybody with any dead come mathematics about them at all to know it's a damn nightmare right now.
Joe, you got about 2.5 minutes to respond to my comment.
I do not think that it's necessary. I think if you you could picture Uncle Sam with about, you know, 10 bankers on his shoulders. That's the reason that you know, the federal government claims that they need to tax us in this manner. But it's really all the bankers and all the waste that is, you know, getting a free ride on the back of Uncle Sam. And so all you have to do is have the population, at least a certain percentage of them, realize that there's all this dead weight that is creating this situation where they, you know, they claim they need all this tax money. But, you know, most of the activities, or much of the activity that the federal government does, is not even constitutional. And in fact, the way they get away with it is by having strings attached, you know, various grants and things that they do. So, it's absolutely not necessary. The country functioned for a long, long time, up until 1913, without an income tax. So, definitely not necessary.
Well, Joe, we've got about 1 minute left. I want to give you the opportunity to make whatever final comment that you want.
Thanks, Terry. Basically, just thank you very much for having me. You know, again, if people want to check out the those recent newsletters at agentfortruth.com, also my long-standing website is freedomabovefortune.com. There is some really good information at truthattack.org, and I would just encourage people to educate themselves and continue to educate your friends and neighbors. And just like, you know, the Ron Paul campaign is realizing, it really does make a difference to just get out there and speak in your communities. And, you know, people are waking up in huge numbers.
Well, we really appreciate you coming on, and I think we're going to have you back because I think there's a lot more to talk about that we haven't even touched on. And we're going to do a show on this spiritual battle, Joe, and we're thinking about getting some folks like maybe Tim Baldwin on with us, let Red have an opportunity to speak. But I think that might be a show you might want to join us for.
Well, happy to be invited. You've been very kind, and I've enjoyed it very much.
Well, you've been great, and thank you very much, and we'll be in touch with you, and I'll even email you with Red's number because it sounds like he'd like to have a private conversation with you. Randall, thanks for joining us. Kirk, thanks. Kate, Red, been awesome. See everyone next week on Laws in Our Minds.